Philosopher Joanna Macy writes of the oblivion we manufacture for ourselves to keep us from looking environmental problems straight in the eye. She quotes R.J. Clifton, a psychologist studying human response to catastrophe. Suppression of our natural responses to disaster is part of the disease of our time. The refusal to acknowledge these responses causes a dangerous splitting. It divorces our mental calculations from our intuitive, emotional, and biological embeddedness in the matrix of life. That split allows us passively to acquiesce in the preparations for our own demise. Waste beds, a new name for an entirely new ecosystem. Waste. We use the word as a noun to mean a leftover residue, refuse, or rubbish, or a material such as feces, which is produced by a living body but not used. More contemporary uses are an unwanted product of manufacturing, an industrial material rejected or thrown away. Wasteland is, therefore, land that has been thrown away. As a verb, to waste means to render the valuable useless, to diminish, to dissipate, and to squander. I wonder how the public perception of the Solvay wastebeds would change if instead of hiding them, we put up a sign along the highway welcoming people to the lakeshore defined as squandered land covered in industrial feces. Ruined land was accepted as the collateral damage of progress. But back in the 1970s, Professor Norm Richards of the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse decided to conduct one of the first studies of the dysfunctional ecology of the wastebeds. Frustrated by local officials' lack of concern, Storm and Norman took matters into his own hands. Following the same lane I walked years later, he snuck into the fenced-off lakeshore and unloaded his guerrilla garden equipment, wheeling his backyard lawn seeder out to the long sloping beds that faced the highway. He pushed the load of grass seed and fertilizer back and forth with measured steps, north 20 paces, east 10 paces, north again. A few weeks later, the word help appeared, written in grass letters 40 feet long on the barren slopes. The scale of the wastelands left room for a longer treatise in fertilized script, but that single word was the right one. The land had been kidnapped, bound and gagged. It could not speak for itself. The wastebeds are not unique. The cause and the chemistry vary from my homeland to yours, but each of us can name these wounded places. We hold them in our minds and our hearts. The question is, what do we do in response? We could take the path of fear and despair. We could document every scary scene of ecological destruction and never run out of material for a haunted hayride of environmental disasters, constructing a shocking nightmare tableau of environmental tragedies in rooms carved from a monoculture of invasive plants on the shore of the most chemically contaminated lake in the United States. There could be scenes of oiled pelicans. How about chainsaw murders on clear-cut slopes washing into rivers? Corpses of extinct Amazon primates, prairies paved over for parking lots, polar bears stranded on melting ice floes. What could such a vision create other than woe and tears? Joanna Macy writes that until we can grieve for a planet, we cannot love it. Grieving is a sign of spiritual health, but it is not enough to weep for our lost landscapes. We have to put our hands in the earth to make ourselves whole again. Even a wounded world is feeding us. Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy. I choose joy over despair, not because I have my head in the sand, but because joy is what the earth gives me daily and I must return the gift. We are deluged by information regarding our destruction of the world and hear almost nothing about how to nurture it. It is no surprise, then, that environmentalism becomes synonymous with dire predictions and powerless feelings. Our natural inclination to do right by the world is stifled, breeding despair when it should be inspiring action. The participatory role of people in the well-being of the land has been lost, our reciprocal relations reduced to a keep-out sign. When my students learn about the latest environmental threat, they are quick to spread the word. They say, "If people only knew that snow leopards are going extinct, if people only knew that rivers are dying, if people only knew, then they would what? Stop?" I honor their faith in people, but so far, the if-then formula isn't working. People do know the consequences of our collective damage. They do know the wages of an extractive economy, but they don't stop. They get very sad. They get very quiet. So quiet that protection of the environment that enables them to eat and breathe and imagine a future for their children doesn't even make it onto a list of their top 10 concerns. The haunted hayride of toxic waste dumps, the melting glaciers, the litany of doomsday projections, they move anyone who is still listening only to despair. Despair is paralysis. It robs us of agency. It blinds us to our own power and the power of the earth. Environmental despair is a poison every bit as destructive as the methylated mercury in the bottom of Onondaga Lake. But how can we submit to despair while the land is saying, "Help"? Restoration is a powerful antidote to despair. Restoration offers concrete means by which humans can once again enter into positive, creative relationship with the more-than-human world, meeting responsibilities that are simultaneously material and spiritual. It's not enough to grieve. It's not enough to just stop doing bad things. We have enjoyed the feast generously laid out for us by Mother Earth, but now the plates are empty and the dining room is a mess. It's time we started doing the dishes in Mother Earth's kitchen. Doing dishes has gotten a bad rap, but everyone who migrates to the kitchen after a meal knows that's where the laughter happens, the good conversations, the friendships. Doing dishes, like doing restoration, forms relationships. How we approach restoration of land depends, of course, on what we believe that land means. If land is just real estate, then restoration looks very different than if land is the source of a subsistence economy and a spiritual home. Restoring land for production of natural resources is not the same as renewal of land as cultural identity. We have to think about what land means. This question and more are played out on the Solvay waste beds. In a sense, the new land of the waste beds represents a blank slate on which a whole range of ideas have been written in response to the urgent message of help. They are scattered over the waste beds in scenes every bit as evocative as the tableau of the haunted hayride. A tour of the Onondaga Lake shore captures the scope of what land might mean and what restoration might look like. Our first stop would have to be the blank slate itself. Greasy, white industrial sludge poured over what was once a grassy green lakeshore. In some places, it is as bare as the day it was spewed, a chalky desert. Our diorama should include a figure of a laborer placing the outfall pipe, but behind him would be the man in the suit. The signpost at stop number one should say land as capital. If land is only a means to make money, then these fellows are doing it right. Norm Richards' help appeal started something back in the 1970s. If nutrients and seed were all it took to green the waste beds, the city had a ready answer. Slopping sewage sludge onto the terraces of the waste beds provided both nutrients for plant growth and a disposal solution for the output of the water treatment plant. The result was the nightmare swards of Phragmites, a dense monoculture of invasive reeds 10 feet high that excludes all other forms of life. Stop number two on our tour. The sign reads, land as property. If land is just private property, a mine of resources, then you can do whatever you want with it and move on. Scarcely 30 years ago, covering up your mess passed for responsibility, a kind of land as a litter box approach. Policy dictated only that land ruined by mining or industry had to be covered by vegetation. With this astroturf strategy, a mining company that destroyed a forest of 200 species could satisfy its legal responsibilities by planting the tailings to alfalfa under a mist of irrigation and fertilizer. Once federal inspectors checked and signed off, the company could put up a mission accomplished banner, turn off the sprinklers, and walk away. The vegetation disappeared almost as quickly as the corporate executives. Happily, scientists like Norm Richards and a host of others had a better idea. When I was at the University of Wisconsin in the early 1980s, on summer evenings I would walk with a young Bill Jordan through the trails of the Arboretum, where a collection of natural ecosystems had been put in place on abandoned farmland, homage to Aldo Leopold's advice that the first step to intelligent tinkering is to save all the pieces. At a time when the toll taken by places like the Solvay waste beds was finally being understood, Bill envisioned a whole science of restoration ecology, in which ecologists would turn their skills and philosophy to healing land, not by imposing an industrial blanket of vegetation, but by recreating natural landscapes. He didn't submit to despair. He didn't let his idea sit on the shelf. He was the catalyst for and a co-founder of the Society for Ecological Restoration. As a result of efforts like his, new laws and policy demanded evolution in the concept of restoration. Restored sites would have to not only look like nature, but have functional integrity as well. The National Research Council defined ecological restoration thus: the return of an ecosystem to a close approximation of its condition prior to disturbance. In restoration, ecological damage to the resource is repaired. Both the structure and the function of the ecosystem are recreated. Merely recreating form without the function, or the function in an artificial configuration bearing little resemblance to a natural resource, does not constitute restoration. The goal is to emulate nature. If we got back on the hayride wagon, it would take us to a restoration experiment at stop number three, another version of what this land might be, what it might mean. It's visible from way off, in big quilted blocks of vivid green against the chalky white. Moving like a field of grass, you can hear the sound of wind in the willows. This scene might be titled Land as Machine and be peopled with mannequins of engineers and foresters who are in charge of the machine. They stand before the ravenous jaws of a brush hog and an unending plantation of shrub willows as thick as the Phragmites and not much more diverse. Their goal is to reestablish structure and especially function to a very specific purpose. Here the intention is to utilize the plants as an engineering solution to water pollution. When rainwater leaches through the waste beds, it picks up high concentrations of salt, alkali, and a host of other compounds that it carries right to the lake. Willows are champions of absorbing water, which they transpire to the atmosphere. The idea is to use the willows as a green sponge, a living machine to intercept the rain before it gets down into the sludge. As an added benefit, the willows can be mown down periodically and used as woody feedstock for biomass fuel digesters. Use of plants in phytoremediation schemes holds promise, but an industrial monoculture of willow, however well-meaning, does not quite meet the standard for true restoration. This kind of fix is at the core of the mechanistic view of nature, in which land is a machine and humans are the drivers. In this reductionist, materialist paradigm, an imposed engineering solution makes sense. But what if we took the indigenous worldview? The ecosystem is not a machine, but a community of sovereign beings, subjects rather than objects. What if those beings were the drivers? We can clamber back on the hay wagon to travel to the next display. Only this one is not well marked. It sprawls across the oldest lakeside section of the beds into a scruffy patchwork of vegetation. The restoration ecologists here at stop number 4 are not university scientists or corporate engineers, but the oldest and most effective of land healers. They are the plants themselves, representing the design firm of Mother Nature and Father Time, LLC. After that momentous Halloween excursion years ago, I felt completely at ease on the waste beds and enjoyed rambling there to watch the restoration in action. I never encountered another dead body. But that is part of the problem. It is, of course, dead bodies that build soil, that perpetuate the nutrient cycle that propels the living. The soil here is white emptiness. Here on the waste beds, there are expanses without a living thing. But there are also teachers of healing, and their names are birch and alder, aster and plantain, cattail, moss, and switchgrass. On the most barren ground, on the wounds we have inflicted, the plants have not turned their backs on us. Instead, they have come. A few brave trees have become established, mostly cottonwoods and aspens that can tolerate the soil. There are clumps of shrubs, some patches of asters and goldenrod, but mostly a thin, scraggly collection of the common roadside weeds. Dandelions, ragweed, chicory, and Queen Anne's lace, blown to this spot, have made a go of it. Nitrogen-fixing legumes in abundance, clovers of all kinds, have also come to do their work. That struggling field of green is to me a form of peacemaking. Plants are the first restoration ecologists. They are using their gifts for healing the land, showing us the way. Imagine the surprise of the infant plants who emerge from their seed coats to find a waste bed habitat no one in their long botanical lineage had ever experienced. Most died of drought, of salt or exposure, or starved from lack of nutrients, but a select few survived and did their best to carry on, especially the grasses. When I dig my trowel under a grassy patch, the soil is different. The waste below is no longer pure white and slippery, but dark gray and crumbly between my fingers. There are roots all through it. The darkening of the soil is humus mixed in. The waste is being changed. True, a few inches down it is still dense and white. But the surface layer holds promise. The plants are doing their work, rebuilding the nutrient cycle. If you get down on your knees, you'll see ant hills, no bigger than a quarter. The granulated soil the ants have mounded around the hole is as white as snow. Grain by grain, In their tiny mandibles, they are carrying up waste from below and carrying seeds and bits of leaves down into the soil, shuttling back and forth. The grasses feed the ants with seeds, and the ants feed the grasses with soil. They hand off life to one another. They understand their interconnections. They understand that the life of one is dependent on the life of all. Leaf by leaf, root by root, the trees, the berries, the grasses are joining forces. And so there are birds and deer and bugs that have come to join them. And so the world is made. Gray birches dot the top of the waste bed, arriving on the wind, no doubt, and lodging fortuitously against a gelatinous clot of nostoc algae bubbling in a puddle. Protected in the selfless scum of nostoc, the birch can grow and thrive on its nitrogen inputs. They are now the biggest trees here, but they're not alone. Directly beneath almost every birch are small shrubs. Not just any shrubs, but those that make juicy fruits. Pincherry, honeysuckle, buckthorn, blackberry. These shrubs are largely absent from the bare expanse between the birches. This apron of fruit bearers speaks of the birds who passed over the waste beds and stopped to perch on the trees, to defecate their load of seeds into the shade of the birch. More fruit drew more birds, who dropped more seeds, who fed the ants, and so it goes. That same pattern of reciprocity is written all over the landscape. That's one of the things I honor about this place. Here you can see beginnings, the small incremental processes by which an ecological community is built. The beds are greening over. The land knows what to do when we do not. I hope that the waste beds do not disappear entirely, though. We need them to remind us of what we are capable of. We have an opportunity to learn from them, to understand ourselves as students of nature, not the masters. The very best scientists are humble enough to listen. We could name this tableau Land as Teacher, Land as Healer. With plants and natural processes in sole command, the role of land as a renewable source of knowledge and ecological insight becomes apparent. Human damage has created novel ecosystems, and the plants are slowly adapting and showing us the way toward healing the wounds. This is a testament to the ingenuity and wisdom of plants more than to any action of people. I hope we'll have the wisdom to let them continue their work. Restoration is an opportunity for a partnership, for us to help. Our part of the work is not complete. In just the last few years, the lake has offered signs of hope. As factories have closed and citizens of the watershed build better sewage treatment plants, the waters have responded to that care. The natural resilience of the lake is making its presence known in tiny increments of dissolved oxygen and returning fish. Hydrogeologists have redirected the energies of the mud boils so that their load is lightened. Engineers, scientists, and activists have all applied the gift of human ingenuity on behalf of the water. The water, too, has done its part. With lessened inputs, the lakes and streams seem to be cleaning themselves as the water moves through. In some places, plants are starting to inhabit the bottom. Trout were found once again in the lake, and when water quality took an upward turn, it was front page news. A pair of eagles have been spotted on the north shore. The waters have not forgotten their responsibility. The waters are reminding the people that they can use their healing gifts when we will use ours. The cleansing potential of the water itself is a powerful force, which gives even greater weight to the work that lies ahead. The presence of eagles seems a sign of their faith in the people, too. And yet, what will become of them as they fish from the wounded waters? The slowly accreting community of weedy species can be a partner in restoration. They are developing ecosystem structure and function, beginning ever so slowly to create ecosystem services such as nutrient cycling, biodiversity, and soil formation. In a natural system, of course, there's no goal other than the proliferation of life. In contrast, professional restoration ecologists design their work to move toward the reference ecosystem, or the pre-damage native condition. The volunteer successional community creating itself on the waste beds is naturalized, but it is not native. It is unlikely to lead to a plant community that the Onondaga Nation would recognize from their ancestral past. The outcome will not be a native landscape peopled with the plants who lived here when allied chemical was only a gleam in the eye of a smokestack. Given the drastic changes produced by industrial contamination, it is probably not possible to recreate cedar swamps and beds of wild rice without some help. We can trust the plants to do their work, but except for wind-blown volunteers, new species can't get here across highways and acres of industry. Mother Nature and Father Time could use someone to push a wheelbarrow, and a few intrepid beings have volunteered. The plant communities that will thrive in this environment are the ones that are tolerant of salt and the sodden soil. It's tough to imagine a reference ecosystem of native species that could survive. But in pre-settlement times, there were salt springs all around the lake, and they supported one of the rarest of native plant communities, an inland salt marsh. Professor Don Leopold and his students have brought in wheelbarrows full of these missing native plants and conducted planting trials, watching their survival and growth with hopes of playing midwife to the recreation of a salt marsh. I went out to visit with the students to hear their story and look at the plants. Some were dead, some were hanging on, and some were flourishing. I headed to where the green seemed the strongest. I caught a whiff of a fragrance that haunts my memory. And then it was gone. I must have imagined it. I stopped to admire a thriving stand of seaside goldenrod and some asters. To witness the regenerative power of the land tells us that there is resilience here, signs of possibility that arise from partnership between the plants and the people. Don's work fulfills the scientific definition of restoration, working toward ecosystem structure, function, and the delivery of ecosystem services. We should make this nascent native meadow the next stop on the hayride, stop number 5, with a sign that says, "Land as a Responsibility." This work raises the bar for what restoration can mean, to create habitat for our non-human relatives. As hopeful as this tableau of restored vegetation might become, it doesn't feel quite whole. When I visited with the students with shovels in their hands, their pride in the planting was evident. I asked what motivated them in their work, and I heard about getting adequate data and devising a solution and a feasible dissertation. No one mentioned love. Maybe they were afraid. I've sat on too many dissertation committees where students were ridiculed for describing the plants they've worked with for 5 years with so unscientific a term as beautiful. The word love is unlikely to make an appearance, but I know that it is there. That familiar fragrance was tugging at my sleeve again. I raised my eyes to meet the brightest green in the place, shiny blades gleaming in the sun, smiling up at me like a long-lost friend. There she was, sweetgrass, growing in one of the last places I might ever have expected. But I should have known better. Tentatively sending out rhizomes through the sludge, slender tillers marching bravely away. Sweetgrass is a teacher of healing, a symbol of kindness and compassion. She reminded me that it's not the land that has been broken, but our relationship to it. Restoration is imperative for healing the earth, but reciprocity is imperative for long-lasting successful restoration. Like other mindful practices, ecological restoration can be viewed as an act of reciprocity in which humans exercise their caregiving responsibility for the ecosystems that sustain them. We restore the land, and the land restores us. As writer Freeman House cautions, we will continue to need the insights and methodologies of science, but if we allow the practice of restoration to become the exclusive domain of science, we will have lost its greatest promise, which is nothing less than a redefinition of human culture. We may not be able to restore the Onondaga watershed to its pre-industrial condition. The land, plants, animals, and their allies among the human people are making small steps, but ultimately, it is the earth that will restore the structure and function, the ecosystem services. We might debate the authenticity of the desired reference ecosystem, but she will decide. We're not in control. What we are in control of is our relationship to the earth. Nature herself is a moving target, especially in an era of rapid climate change. Species composition may change, but relationship endures. It is the most authentic facet of the restoration. Here is where our most challenging and most rewarding work lies, in restoring a relationship of respect, responsibility, and reciprocity. And love. A 1994 statement from the Indigenous Environmental Network puts it best. Western science and technology, while appropriate to the present scale of degradation, is a limited conceptual and methodological tool. It is the head and hands of restoration implementation. Native spirituality is the heart that guides the head and hands. Cultural survival depends on healthy land and a healthy, responsible relationship between humans and the land. The traditional caregiving responsibilities, which maintained healthy land, need to be expanded to include restoration. Ecological restoration is inseparable from cultural and spiritual restoration, and is inseparable from the spiritual responsibilities of caregiving and world renewal. What if we could fashion a restoration plan that grew from understanding multiple meanings of land? Land as sustainer, land as identity, land as grocery store and pharmacy, land as connection to our ancestors, land as moral obligation, land as sacred, land as self. When I first came to Syracuse as a student, I had a first and only date with a local fellow. We were going on a drive, and I asked if we could go to fabled Onondaga Lake, which I'd never seen. He reluctantly agreed, joking about the city's famous landmark. When we got there, he wouldn't get out of the car. "It stinks too much," he said, as ashamed as if he himself were the source of the foul odor. I'd never met anyone who hated his home before. My friend Catherine grew up here. She tells me that her weekly ride to Sunday school took the family along the lakeshore, past Crucible Steel and Allied Chemical, where even on the Lord's Day, black smoke filled the sky and pools of sludge lay on either side of the road. When the preacher talked of fire and brimstone and the sulfurous vents of hell, she was sure he meant Solvay. She thought she drove to church each week through the valley of death. Fear and loathing, our internal haunted hayride. The worst parts of our nature are all here on the lakeshore. Despair made people turn away, made them write off Onondaga Lake as a lost cause. It's true that when you walk on the waste beds, you can see the hand of destruction, but you can also see hope in the way a seed lands in a tiny crack and puts down a root. and begins to build the soil again. The plants remind me of our neighbors at Onondaga Nation. Native people faced with daunting odds, great hostility, and an environment much changed from the rich land that first sustained them. But the plants and the people survive. Plant people and human people are still here and are still meeting their responsibilities. Despite numerous legal setbacks, the Onondaga have not turned their backs on the lake. Rather, they are the authors of a new approach to healing it, put forward in their Onondaga Nation vision for a clean Onondaga Lake. This dream of restoration follows the ancient teachings of the Thanksgiving Address. Greeting in turn each element of creation, the declaration offers vision and support for returning the lake to health, and with it, a mutual healing of lake and people. It is an exemplar of a new holistic approach called biocultural or reciprocal restoration. In the indigenous worldview, a healthy landscape is understood to be whole and generous enough to be able to sustain its partners. It engages land not as a machine, but as a community of respected non-human persons to whom we humans have a responsibility. Restoration requires renewing the capacity not only for ecosystem services, but for cultural services as well. Renewal of relationships includes water that you can swim in and not be afraid to touch. Restoring relationship means that when the eagles return, it will be safe for them to eat the fish. People want that for themselves too. Biocultural restoration raises the bar for environmental quality of the reference ecosystem so that as we care for the land, it can once again care for us. Restoring land without restoring relationship is an empty exercise. It is relationship that will endure and relationship that will sustain the restored land. Therefore, reconnecting people and the landscape is as essential as reestablishing proper hydrology or cleaning up contaminants. It is medicine for the earth. One day in late September, while earth-moving machinery dredged contaminated soils on the western shore of Onondaga Lake, another group of earth movers worked on the eastern shore, dancing. I watched their feet as they moved in a circle led by the water drum. Beaded moccasins, tassel tie loafers, high top sneakers, flip flops, and patent leather pumps all beat against the ground in a ceremonial dance to honor the water. All the participants carried vessels of clean water from their home places. Their hopes for Onondaga Lake were held in these vessels. Work boots brought spring water from the high hills. Green converses carried city tap water. And red wooden sandals, peeking from below a pink kimono, carried sacred water all the way from Mount Fuji to blend that purity into Onondaga Lake. This ceremony is also restoration ecology, the healing of relationship and the stirring of emotion and spirit on behalf of the water. Singers, dancers, and speakers took the stage by the lake to call for restoration. Faith keeper Orin Lyons, clan mother Audrey Shenandoah, and international activist Jane Goodall joined the community in this water communion to celebrate the sacredness of the lake and to renew the covenant between people and the water. There on the shore where the Tree of Peace once stood, we joined to plant another tree in commemoration of peacemaking with the lake. This should be on the restoration tour too. Stop number 6, land as sacred, land as community. Naturalist E.O. Wilson writes, "There can be no purpose more inspiring than to begin the age of restoration, reweaving the wondrous diversity of life that still surrounds us. The stories are piling up all around, in scraps of land being restored, trout streams reclaimed from siltation, brownfields turned into community gardens, prairies reclaimed from soybeans, wolves howling in their old territories, school kids helping salamanders across the road. If your heart isn't raised by the sight of whooping cranes restored to their ancient flyway, you must not have a pulse. It's true that these victories are as small and fragile as origami cranes, but their power moves as inspiration. Your hands itch to pull out invasive species and replant the native flowers. Your finger trembles with a wish to detonate the explosion of an obsolete dam that would restore a salmon run. These are the antidotes to the poison of despair. Joanna Macy speaks of the great turning, the essential adventure of our time, the shift from the industrial growth society to a life-sustaining civilization. Restoration of land and relationship pushes that turning wheel. Action on behalf of life transforms, because the relationship between self and the world is reciprocal. It is not a question of first getting enlightened or saved and then acting. As we work to heal the earth heals us. The last stop on the ride around the lake hasn't been finished yet, but the scene is planned. In this tableau, there will be kids swimming, families picnicking. People love this lake and take care of it. It's a place for ceremony and celebration. The Haudenosaunee flag flies alongside the stars and stripes. Folks are fishing in the shallows and keeping their catch. Willow trees bend gracefully, their limbs full of birds. An eagle sits at the top of the Tree of Peace. Lakeshore wetlands are rich with muskrats and waterfowl. Native prairies green the lakeshore. The signpost at the scene reads, "Land as home." People of corn, people of light. The story of our relationship to the earth is written more truthfully on the land than on the page. It lasts there. The land remembers what we said and what we did. Stories are among our most potent tools for restoring the land as well as our relationship to land. We need to unearth the old stories that live in a place and begin to create new ones, for we are story makers, not just storytellers. All stories are connected, new ones woven from the threads of the old. One of the ancestor stories that waits for us to listen again with new ears is the Mayan story of creation. It is said that in the beginning there was emptiness. The divine beings, the great thinkers, imagined the world into existence simply by saying its name. The world was populated with a rich flora and fauna called into being by words. But the divine beings were not satisfied. Among the wonderful beings they had created, none were articulate. They could sing and squawk and growl, but none had voice to tell the story of their creation, nor praise it. So the gods set about to make humans. The first humans, the gods shaped of mud. But the gods were none too happy with the result. The people were not beautiful. They were ugly and ill-formed. They could not talk. They could barely walk, and certainly could not dance or sing the praises of the gods. They were so crumbly and clumsy and inadequate that they could not even reproduce and just melted away in the rain. So the gods tried again to make good people who would be givers of respect, givers of praise, providers, and nurturers. To this end, they carved a man from wood and a woman from the pith of a reed. Oh, these were beautiful people, lithe and strong. They could talk and dance and sing. Clever people, too. They learned to use the other beings, plants and animals, for their own purposes. They made many things, farms and pottery and houses and nets to catch fish. As a result of their fine bodies and fine minds and hard work, these people reproduced and populated the world, filling it with their numbers. But after a time, the all-seeing gods realized that these people's hearts were empty of compassion and love. They could sing and talk, but their words were without gratitude for the sacred gifts that they had received. These clever people did not know thanks or caring, and so endangered the rest of the creation. The gods wished to end this failed experiment in humanity, and so they sent great catastrophes to the world. They sent a flood and earthquakes, and most importantly, they loosed the retaliation of the other species. The previously mute trees and fish and clay were given voices for their grief and anger at the disrespect shown them by the humans made of wood. Trees raged against the humans for their sharp axes, the deer for their arrows, and even the pots made of earth and clay rose up in anger for the times they had been carelessly burnt. All of the misused members of creation rallied together and destroyed the people made of wood in self-defense. Once again, the gods tried to make human beings, but this time purely of light, the sacred energy of the sun. These humans were dazzling to behold, 7 times the color of the sun, beautiful, smart, and very, very powerful. They knew so much that they believed they knew everything. Instead of being grateful to the creators for their gifts, they believed themselves to be the gods' equals. The divine beings understood the danger posed by these people made of light, and once more arranged for their demise. And so the gods tried again to fashion humans who would live right in the beautiful world they had created, in respect and gratitude and humility. From 2 baskets of corn, yellow and white, they ground a fine meal, mixed it with water, and shaped a people made of corn. They were fed on corn liquor, and oh, these were good people. They could dance and sing, and they had words to tell stories and offer up prayers. Their hearts were filled with compassion for the rest of creation. They were wise enough to be grateful. The gods had learned their lesson. So to protect the corn people from the overpowering arrogance of their predecessors, the people made of light, they passed a veil before the eyes of the corn people, clouding their vision as breath clouds a mirror. These people of corn are the ones who were respectful and grateful for the world that sustained them, and so they were the people who were sustained upon the earth. Of all the materials, why is it that people of corn would inherit the earth rather than people of mud or wood or light? Could it be that people made of corn are beings transformed? For what is corn, after all, but light transformed by relationship? Corn owes its existence to all 4 elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And corn is the product of relationship, not only with the physical world, but with people too. The sacred plant of our origin created people, and people created corn, a great agricultural innovation from its Theosinte ancestor. Corn cannot exist without us to sow it and tend its growth. Our beings are joined in an obligate symbiosis. From these reciprocal acts of creation arise the elements that were missing from the other attempts to create sustainable humanity: gratitude and a capacity for reciprocity. I've read and loved this story as a history of sorts, a recounting of how, in long-ago times, just at the edge of knowing, people were made of maize and lived happily ever after. But in many indigenous ways of knowing, time is not a river, but a lake in which the past, the present, and the future exist. Creation, then, is an ongoing process, and the story is not history alone. It is also prophecy. Have we already become people of corn? Or are we still people made of wood? Are we people made of light, enthralled to our own power? Are we not yet transformed by relationship to earth? Perhaps this story could be a user's manual for understanding how we become people of corn. The Popol Vuh, the Mayan sacred text in which this story is contained, is perceived as more than just a chronicle. As David Suzuki notes in The Wisdom of the Elders, the Mayan stories are understood as an ilbal, a precious seeing instrument or lens with which to view our sacred relationships. He suggests that such stories may offer us a corrective lens. But while our indigenous stories are rich in wisdom, and we need to hear them, I do not advocate their wholesale appropriation. As the world changes, an immigrant culture must write its own new stories of relationship to place, a new ilbal, but tempered by the wisdom of those who were old on this land long before we came. So how, then, can science, art, and story give us a new lens to understand the relationship that people made of corn represent? Someone once said that sometimes a fact alone is a poem. Just so, the people of corn are embedded in a beautiful poem written in the language of chemistry. The first stanza goes like this: carbon dioxide plus water combined in the presence of light and chlorophyll in the beautiful membrane-bound machinery of life yields sugar and oxygen. Photosynthesis, in other words, in which air, light, and water are combined out of nothingness into sweet morsels of sugar, the stuff of redwoods and daffodils and corn. Straw spun to gold, water turned to wine. Photosynthesis is the link between the inorganic realm and the living world, making the inanimate live. At the same time, it gives us oxygen. Plants give us food and breath. Here is the second stanza, the same as the first, but recited backward. Sugar combined with oxygen in the beautiful membrane-bound machinery of life called the mitochondria yields us right back where we began: carbon dioxide and water. Respiration, the source of energy that lets us farm and dance and speak. The breath of plants gives life to animals, and the breath of animals gives life to plants. My breath is your breath. Your breath is mine. It's the great poem of give and take, of reciprocity that animates the world. Isn't that a story worth telling? Only when people understand the symbiotic relationships that sustain them can they become people of corn. capable of gratitude and reciprocity. The very facts of the world are a poem. Light is turned to sugar. Salamanders find their way to ancestral ponds following magnetic lines radiating from the earth. The saliva of grazing buffalo causes the grass to grow taller. Tobacco seeds germinate when they smell smoke. Microbes in industrial waste can destroy mercury. Aren't these stories we should all know? Who is it that holds them? In long ago times, it was the elders who carried them. In the 21st century, it is often scientists who first hear them. The stories of buffalo and salamanders belong to the land, but scientists are one of their translators and carry a large responsibility for conveying their stories to the world. And yet scientists mostly convey these stories in a language that excludes readers. Conventions for efficiency and precision make reading scientific papers very difficult for the rest of the world, and if the truth be known, for us as well. This has serious consequences for public dialogue about the environment, and therefore for real democracy, especially the democracy of all species. For what good is knowing unless it is coupled with caring? Science can give us knowing, but caring comes from someplace else. I think it's fair to say that if the Western world has an ill ball, it is science. Science lets us see the dance of the chromosomes, the leaves of moss, and the farthest galaxy. But is it a sacred lens like the Popol Vuh? Does science allow us to perceive the sacred in the world, or does it bend light in such a way as to obscure it? A lens that brings the material world into focus but blurs the spiritual is the lens of a people made of wood. It is not more data that we need for our transformation to people of corn, but more wisdom. While science could be a source of and repository for knowledge, the scientific worldview is all too often an enemy of ecological compassion. It is important in thinking about this lens to separate two ideas that are too often synonymous in the mind of the public: the practice of science and the scientific worldview that it feeds. Science is the process of revealing the world through rational inquiry. The practice of doing real science brings the questioner into an unparalleled intimacy with nature, fraught with wonder and creativity as we try to comprehend the mysteries of the more-than-human world. Trying to understand the life of another being or another system so unlike our own is often humbling, and for many scientists is a deeply spiritual pursuit. Contrasting with this is the scientific worldview, in which a culture uses the process of interpreting science in a cultural context that uses science and technology to reinforce reductionist, materialist, economic, and political agendas. I maintain that the destructive lens of the people made of wood is not science itself, but the lens of the scientific worldview, the illusion of dominance and control, the separation of knowledge from responsibility. I dream of a world guided by a lens of stories rooted in the revelations of science and framed with an indigenous worldview. Stories in which matter and spirit are both given voice. Scientists are particularly good at learning about the lives of other species. The stories they could tell convey the intrinsic values of the lives of other beings, lives every bit as interesting, maybe more so, as those of Homo sapiens. But while scientists are among those who are privy to these other intelligences, many seem to believe that the intelligence they access is only their own. They lack the fundamental ingredient, humility. After the gods experimented with arrogance, they gave the people of Korn humility, and it takes humility to learn from other species. In the indigenous view, humans are viewed as somewhat lesser beings in the democracy of species. We are referred to as the younger brothers of creation. So, like younger brothers, we must learn from our elders. Plants were here first and have had a long time to figure things out. They live both above and below ground and hold the earth in place. Plants know how to make food from light and water. Not only do they feed themselves, but they make enough to sustain the lives of all of the rest of us. Plants are providers for the rest of the community and exemplify the virtue of generosity, always offering food. What if Western scientists saw plants as their teachers rather than their subjects? What if they told stories with that lens? Many indigenous peoples share the understanding that we are each endowed with a particular gift, a unique ability. Birds to sing and stars to glitter, for instance. It is understood that these gifts have a dual nature, though. A gift is also a responsibility. If the bird's gift is song, then it has a responsibility to greet the day with music. It is the duty of birds to sing, and the rest of us receive the song as a gift. Asking what is our responsibility is perhaps also to ask, what is our gift, and how shall we use it? Stories like the one about the people of Korn give us guidance, both to recognize the world as gift and to think about how we might respond. The people of mud and wood and light all lacked gratitude and the sense of reciprocity that flowed from it. It was only the people of Korn, people transformed by awareness of their gifts and responsibilities, who were sustained on the earth. Gratitude comes first, but gratitude alone is not enough. Other beings are known to be especially gifted, with attributes that humans lack. Other beings can fly, see at night, rip open trees with their claws, make maple syrup. What can humans do? We may not have wings or leaves, but we humans do have words. Language is our gift and our responsibility. I've come to think of writing as an act of reciprocity with the living land. Words to remember old stories. Words to tell new ones. Stories that bring science and spirit back together to nurture our becoming people made of Korn.